I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The Iowa caucuses will take place in just under 2 months. It'll be the first of many contests to determine which Democratic candidate will get the presidential nomination. Today, an overview of the presidential primary process and Iowa's unique role in it. We'll learn how often the caucus winner goes on to win the presidency and how many voters take part. Then, legendary Kansas City sportscaster Al Wallace spent 40 years in his dream job and survived cancer along the way. He opens up about the hurdles he faced. I'll ask what stands out the most and why, as a sports fanatic, he never wanted to cover the Super Bowl. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. It may be hard to believe, but it's almost Iowa time again. That is, we're almost exactly 2 months away from the first in the nation Iowa caucuses. The vote there will give us our first sense of how the Democratic presidential candidates are stacking up with American voters. But why does Iowa always get to go first? Missouri, after all, is far more representative of the U.S. population. So maybe Missouri should be first, for once. Yet it never works out that way. Missouri and Kansas won't vote until lots of other states have already done so. Now, a conversation about America's presidential nominating process and Iowa's preeminent place in it. With us, David Redlosk is chair of the Department of Political Science and International Relations at the University of Delaware. He's a five-time Iowa Precinct Caucus Chair and one of the authors of Why Iowa? How Caucuses and Sequential Elections Improve the Presidential Nominating Process. David, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You know, who decided that Iowa should always go first in the nominating process?
Nobody really
Who's
did.
Responsible
it's
for
right,
this, David?
Exactly. Yeah. And even Iowa is not directly responsible for it in the sense that, as I've looked into the history of it, nobody really planned it this way.
Mm-hmm.
To cut to the chase, essentially after the 1968 Democratic Convention, which was a complete disaster for the Democrats,
right.
Riot, you know, the police riot in Chicago and so on. The Democrats said, you know, we've got to open up the process a bit. Insurgent groups were very angry that Hubert Humphrey was nominated. It was all done by the bosses in the traditional smoke-filled rooms.
Mm-hmm.
And so the party created a commission to look at its rules. How do you open up the process? Among the many changes they made was one that turned out to have unintended consequences, and that was that the process had to be more public. The public had to be invited in. It had to know it was happening. What that meant for Iowa, which had always had caucuses, the caucuses in Iowa for both parties go back to the beginning of the state.
Hmm.
Caucuses are used to do party business, to organize things, and to show presidential preference. But they happened at a time nobody paid attention. What a caucus really was back in the day before all this change was, you know, the local party leader would say, hey, you know, Joe, Bill, we're going to caucus in my living room tomorrow night. Let's go have our caucus. Public wouldn't know about it. Regular voters never heard about it. The rules changed that. The rules required that caucuses be advertised publicly. But more importantly for Iowa, they required that caucuses and conventions be advertised publicly. Iowa has a four-step process. Each part of the process needed 30 days of advertising. So if you start with the Iowa State Convention normally in June
then
and
move
work
backwards,
it pushed the caucuses earlier than ever before. But there was one other little funny thing, and that was they couldn't do the state convention in June like they normally did because there was apparently a big, I think it was an agricultural convention. There were no rooms at the inn. So the convention had – the Democratic convention happened earlier, pushed the caucuses even earlier, and it jumped New Hampshire.
So it's a fluke then
it's
that Iowa's
first. It's essentially a fluke.
In
72, Iowa jumped New Hampshire, went first. No one paid attention. No one really cared.
So I can't help but wonder then, Professor, why has the state been able to hold on to the number one slot for so long? Because a lot of people complain about the idea that Iowa is always first. It's certainly not a God-given right, if you just explained.
No, it's not a God-given right, although for a lot of Iowans it seems to be now.
It seems to be, yeah.
Why has it stayed that way? Well, part of it is Jimmy Carter's fault. In the 1976 election, Carter, of course, was a not very well-known governor of Georgia, trying to get some traction in the presidential nomination. And his folks looked at Iowa and said, you know, that's going to be first. People are going to vote there. Maybe we can get the media to pay some attention to it.
Right.
So Carter campaigns for about a day and a half in Iowa. They've convinced the media to pay some attention to the results because – it would be the first time anyone voted, and Carter wins the caucuses, and it becomes a national story. Well, he didn't win the caucuses. He came in second to uncommitted.
Yes.
But nonetheless,
right.
He then became president, of course, and it set the myth that winning Iowa would be the pathway to the presidency.
But still, why has the state been able to hang on to it and be first every time out when so many other states over the years have said, we want to be first?
Yep. Well, there are a couple reasons. One is it's in state law that they will be first, so they just move the caucuses as early as necessary.
It's a law now, you're saying.
It's a law.
Because there's economic development attached to this with candidates coming to the state and spending lots of money.
Yeah, there's some sense of that, although it's not clear that the economic effects are that great, but certainly the PR effects are quite significant, right? Mm-hmm. Nobody would be paying attention to Iowa. It's also very valuable to the parties because the parties develop the lists of caucus goers that can then be sold to the campaigns. Mm-hmm. And so the parties and the campaigns, the candidates help support the parties. So it's valuable to them. But the real reason I think that Iowa stayed first after Jimmy Carter, besides the parties working together and state law being written this way, is simply that it's a bit of a game theory problem. That is, everybody wants to be first. How do you decide if it isn't Iowa who it's going to be?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it's easier to keep Iowa number one and just never mind the other big argument.
Absolutely. And in fact, that's what's happened, particularly with the Democrats, but also the Republicans as well. They've carved out this period of time in February where this initial set of states led by Iowa gets to go before anybody else. States cannot start their primaries until March 3rd this coming year,
mm-hmm.
but Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina get a pass on that rule.
I'm visiting with political scientist David Redlosk about the Iowa caucuses coming up in February and the presidential nominating process. I mean, the argument again that you hear so often is that Iowa isn't representative of much of anything. It's too white. It's too rural. Is that valid?
It's partially valid. When we looked at Iowa in the context of its representativeness for our research that led to the book Why Iowa, one of the things we looked at was the economic side. And it turns out, some work by a colleague, Mike Lewis Beck, that Iowa is kind of the median state, or at least was when we were looking at it, in terms of economic indicators. It's the middle state. And in some sense, on that side of the coin, it's actually quite representative. It's also much more urban than people think it is. Like most Midwestern states, the rural counties have emptied out, right? People have moved into the urban
areas.
Des Moines, Cedar Rapids,
yeah.
Exactly, mm-hmm. Davenport. And so Iowa actually is not as rural from the standpoint of the population or even the economy as it appears to be. Having said that, it's certainly demographically not representative of either the Democratic Party or the country. But then again, no single state is demographically representative.
Missouri used to come pretty close.
Yeah, no, I mean, there are a number of states that are close. But in a sense, the way I like to think about this is it's less about Iowa and more about all four of the first states. For the Democrats, if you take Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, Nevada, you have the Democratic Party. South Carolina is heavily African American, 60% of—
You combine those states,
right.
You have a pretty good sample.
Exactly,
you
do. And you absolutely do. For the Republicans, this is less of an issue. The party is more homogenous. They don't worry as much about it politically or ideologically. And so there isn't the battle on the Republican side. that there is on the Democratic side.
So Iowa is number one again this year. I'm wondering, how often does the winner of the Iowa caucuses go on to be the next president of the United States?
So it's probably the better way to think about it is, how often does the winner become the nominee? Because then, you know, only one side's going to win the presidency.
Right.
And what really happened, it's really different between the two parties. Up until 2000, it was more a myth than reality. Jimmy Carter and, you know, not a whole lot else going on. After 2000, or starting with 2000, for the Democrats, every Democratic nominee has won Iowa first. That historically is an anomaly. Whether it will hold again, we don't know. But for the Republicans, it's not the case. Iowa really does not determine the nominee or the presidency on the Republican side. What Iowa really does for the Republicans and also for the Democrats is tell us who is not going to be president. It winnows the field.
You hear this phrase all the time, there are three tickets out of Iowa. What does that mean, David?
What it typically has meant is the it starts with the fact the media cannot focus on everybody and everything, right? And so the media is looking for stories that are interesting, and they're looking for ways to focus on the campaigns. Three tickets out of Iowa basically means you need to be in the top three to have any shot at going forward and actually winning the nomination. Mm-hmm. It's not strictly true, but it's a pretty good indicator.
John McCain, I think, finished fourth back in 2008.
McCain is one exception right now. But I also think that that's not exactly the right way to look at it. The way to look at it instead is the candidates who get the most attention out of Iowa are the ones who surprise in Iowa.
That's interesting.
And they can surprise both directions, do worse than expected, in which case they'll get the stories writing them off, or do better than expected, in which case they'll get the stories saying, look at this trajectory, look what's going on. Now, they can't always turn it into anything. Marco Rubio, last time around, is the example here. Rubio did way better than his polling in the final results in Iowa. We documented that his media attention just skyrocketed. Unfortunately for him, he then got crushed in New Hampshire.
You know, it's interesting how the media talks about winners and losers and expectations. I remember back in 2008, there was a storyline that suggested that Barack Obama, if he didn't win Iowa, it was all over and that Hillary Clinton would go on to win the nomination. Why was it seen as so critical for Barack Obama to win that year?
You have to remember that coming into the 2008 cycle, Clinton was the front runner nationally in the polling. She was far better known. You know, Obama had given an exhilarating speech in 2004 at the convention, so had some attention. But Clinton was, you know, she was just much better known. She was better positioned.
Sure.
And Obama had to basically prove himself, had to prove that voters would vote for him. In his case, as the and some would disagree and say other candidates were serious candidates, but as really the first serious African-American candidate, one of the barriers he faced was, would white voters vote for him?
And Iowa had plenty of those.
And they certainly did. The really fascinating thing about Obama's trajectory is that Clinton had South Carolina locked down, African-American vote in South Carolina. Bill Clinton, sometimes called the first black president, deep roots with the community. Obama was seen, what a nice young boy, but he can't win yet, right? Mm-hmm. He's too young. He's too inexperienced. They'll never vote for him. And then he wins Iowa, and the African-American vote in South Carolina shifts. And it really makes the difference.
Iowa mattered.
Yeah, Iowa mattered a lot.
You know, so as we sit here today, Professor, and you look ahead to the caucuses in a couple of months, does Joe Biden have to win the Iowa Democratic caucuses, or what are the expectations as we sit here today?
So that you're the way you just put that, what are the expectations, is absolutely the key, right? Surprising is about beating expectations, and the expectations get set by fundraising, polling, and media attention. The Democratic nomination right now is really fuzzy to me. There are four front runners in Iowa. They've, you know, lately Buttigieg had popped up, but, you know, Warren was in the lead. Biden was in the lead. Sanders may or may not be close to them.
Right.
And I think it's probably less the case this time around that any one of them has to win Iowa. But what they can't do is
tank.
Tank, yeah. Exactly. So Biden, for example, probably doesn't have to come in first, but he probably can't come in fourth either.
Mm-hmm.
Biden's a little bit in the position that Clinton was in 08, in that he has very strong support among African-American voters in South Carolina, close to half. No one's close to him. But it's based heavily on the idea that he's the candidate who can beat Trump.
Mm-hmm.
If he does not do mm-hmm. well in Iowa, that aura of a winner may dissipate and those voters may start looking for alternatives.
You know, David, I should have asked this sooner, but what is the difference between a primary and a caucus? Explain, because we're talking about a different deal here, where a primary, you walk in, you cast a vote at a voting machine and leave. A caucus, you're having a meeting, maybe in someone's house, as you said, or at a school or at a church. It's a different animal altogether.
It really is. I mean, most people, you know, if you've ever voted in any kind of regular election, a general election or a primary, you know, you go in there and as you said, you just cast your vote on a machine, on paper, whatever your system is, and you leave, and it takes you a couple minutes to cast the vote. It might take you a lot longer to stand in line.
In the caucus is a lot more time.
Caucus is a lot more time consuming. The process is slower, particularly for the Democrats. The Democrats and Republicans have different processes, but we're focused this year on the Democrats. And the process is more time consuming. You have to vote publicly, so it's not a secret ballot for the Democrats. You publicly stand up for your candidate, literally moving to corners of the room.
The Biden people go in this corner. The Sanders people go over here. The Warren people go over there.
Exactly. Yeah. And you wait to be counted. At that point in your precinct, if your candidate does not have 15% support, called the threshold, the viability threshold, then you get to make a second choice because your candidate will not be viable. That doesn't happen in primaries. If your candidate doesn't get 15% in the primary, your candidate's just going to get no delegates and you as a voter become unrepresented.
Mm-hmm.
In the caucuses, you can at least express your second choice and therefore be represented in the delegate process.
So a voter has to be pretty engaged here. A voter has to have a first choice, a second choice. You don't know what's going to happen in your neighborhood caucus. And there are literally thousands of these things around the state that all take place on this one night.
Yeah, there are more than 1,700 precinct caucuses in Iowa this year.
Okay. Yeah.
And they vary in size, of course. Some in the rural areas are very small. Some in the urban areas, Iowa City, there will be precincts with 800, 900, 1,000 people in them. Obviously, getting 1,000 people in a space is a very different dynamic than getting 25,
mm-hmm.
right? The old-style caucuses where 25 people, you will spend time talking. You will spend time debating issues. You will spend time thinking about the process. In these very large caucuses these days, it will be a bit chaotic, and it will be just lucky that everything can get counted accurately.
So is it that initial head count of where people, who they stand up for, is that what gets called into party headquarters and becomes the vote count for each of the candidates that the media looks at that night?
So again, to make clear, of course, we're talking about the Democrats. The Republicans just cast a vote. They just do the normal thing in a box, and then they count them. For the Democrats, you have this what we call the first alignment, which is where everybody is at the beginning. Who do you support? And so candidate X has 14% and candidate Y has 25%. X is not viable.
Mm-hmm.
Those numbers historically were never publicized. Instead, the second round after the viability threshold was counted and turned into delegates.
Mm-hmm.
Each precinct gets a certain number of delegates. And then the Democrat Party would report the delegate count. So the result was, last time, Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, each got about half of the delegates. But the Sanders people were convinced, and I think they're probably right, they had more people at the caucuses, but those numbers have never been reported. That will be different this time. The Iowa Democratic Party is going to report the initial alignment, so we will know how people vote when they come into the caucus. They're going to report the final vote after all of the non-viable candidates are eliminated, and they will report the delegates. And there is some possibility these could result in different people leading at different points.
Oh, man. So this is a mouthful this time around.
It is. And I honestly am not sure how the media is going to manage it.
Yeah. Well, one more thing about how important this is. As you said earlier, Professor, this is the beginning of a process, a four-stage process. Given that it's four steps here, why does the first step get so much attention? Just because it's the first step?
Yeah. This all goes back to the idea that this is the very first time people are going to cast votes, right? We have lots and lots of polling, especially these days. We have polls constantly. But a poll is not the vote. Right. This will be the very first time anybody casts a vote. And given the nature of the system, that is interesting. Mm-hmm. We'd like to know what voters are thinking. And this will be very concrete evidence about what voters are thinking.
You know, over the years, even recent years, Missouri and Kansas, the different parties have sometimes used a caucus system. How common is it for states to still use caucuses in their in the primary phase of the nominating process?
It has now become very uncommon. The caucuses are basically been all but eliminated. I think there are three states left doing caucuses for the Democrats this year. And that's partly because the Democratic Party rules have been designed to push caucuses out. They don't think they're transparent enough. We mentioned that they take a commitment. They're hard to do. Fewer people go to caucus than vote in primaries.
It's confusing. Yeah.
And you have to make this – you have to get out of your house at a particular time, probably a cold winter night, and go somewhere and vote publicly. So in a sense, I think the Democratic Party nationally – is really moved against caucuses, and most of the states have followed suit.
You know, David, I've heard you say that the good thing about Iowa is that it requires that the candidates speak to voters directly all over the state. But I've spent a lot of time in Iowa over the years, and yes, they do talk to voters, but it always seems to me that it's the candidates who do most of the talking here.
Well, you know, candidates will give their stump speech, and some of them go on a very long time
yes,
and do most of the talking.
Yes, they do.
Elizabeth Warren the other day turned it around, and I think it was a very smart move. She gave about an 8-minute stump speech and took well over a dozen questions and drove the entire town hall on Q&A.
Right.
Other candidates ought to do that. That does connect the voters more directly. But you're seeing the public events. Right. There is an awful lot that goes on behind the scenes that's not as obvious where candidates really are talking to voters.
Just a final point here. A lot of Democrats say this year that whoever they nominate will wind up being the next president because Donald Trump's poll numbers are so lousy, at least on the job approval side of things. You buy that?
It's hard to beat a sitting president. Historically, you have to start with the prior expectation the president will be reelected. On the other hand, the data based on history suggests that he won't be reelected. But, you know, the data suggested he wouldn't be elected in the first place. I don't think it's as clear cut as a lot of people think it is.
That's David Redlosk. He's one of the authors of Why Iowa, How Caucuses and Sequential Elections Improve the Presidential Nominating Process. He's spending a year at the University of Iowa this year. He's chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of Delaware. David, thanks so much for your time. I sure appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. It was fun.
Up next, he was a fixture of WDAF sports reporting for more than three decades. Al Wallace joins me to talk about the memoir he's written on his career and life. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR 89.3. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Sign up for my weekly newsletter, Kraske Off Mic. You'll get commentary from me and highlights from the up-to-date crew in your inbox each Monday. Sign up now at kcur.org/Kraske. Tomorrow on the program, segregation and exclusion in Kansas City schools is alive and well. We'll get an historic and contemporary look at the dividing lines on Wednesday's Up to Date. Well, Al Wallace was a sports broadcaster on WDAF for more than 30 years in Kansas City. He covered Royals and Chiefs and Jayhawks, but along the way, he worked hard to avoid getting too emotionally attached to any one team. In his new autobiography, he says that while he wanted the Chiefs to succeed, he never had the desire to cover the Super Bowl. We're going to ask Al about that in a moment and how he survived 40 years in TV news and beat cancer along the way. Al Wallace's new book is One for the Coyotes, and he joins us now from Lawrence. Al, it's nice to have you. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. It's great to be here.
You never had the desire to cover a Super Bowl, Al? I mean, really? You were a sportscaster. What's wrong with the Super Bowl?
The Super Bowl is too big. The Super Bowl is enormous.
Yeah.
And when you are a sports reporter or sports anchor covering the Super Bowl, you are part of a herd, let's put it that way. Super Bowl media day, what, 2,500 personnel?
Yeah.
A little bit too big. Now, I'm not saying I wouldn't go. I'm not saying I would have never covered it. It was just not a big desire of mine to cover a Super Bowl.
Did you feel the same way about the World Series and other big the Final Four, for that matter?
Not at all. Those, to me, those were two different animals, if you will. Both very popular events, but the Super Bowl is global. And those other two events you mentioned, a Final Four and a World Series, even though they are local, a Super Bowl is less local. It's more global. And I covered 9 Final Fours. I covered 3 World Series while working at Fox 4 and WDAF-TV, which I still call Kansas City's oldest and most trusted television station.
Still loyal after all these years, Al.
Oh,
good for you.
Absolutely, yeah. Have to be. I worked there 33 years. I used to live there.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you bet. Still loyal.
Well, what was the toughest part of the job?
The toughest part of the job, especially in the last 9 years or 10 years, to be honest with you, was being away from my family. And having to put things in perspective after I was diagnosed with cancer in late 2011. I was diagnosed with prostate cancer.
Right.
And, you know, life became, I looked at it through a different lens. And being away from my family so often on so many nights and so many days and mornings. I mean, Chiefs go to training camp, and there were times where I'd be at work at 9 o'clock in the morning. I'd get home at 11 o'clock at night.
Mm-hmm.
There were many 6- and 7-day work weeks. And sure, I got to comp time later, but that was the toughest part of the job, especially late in my career of working television news, television sports, was being away from the family.
Hey, these were the years after Frank Bohl, who was your boss for many years at WDAF. These were the years after he had left and taken a buyout. And you said you lost a little bit of interest in the job. It wasn't the same kind of job it had been before.
Steve, just like any other industry, things change, things evolve. And the industry of television news has evolved in so many different ways, technology. But in a lot of ways, or if I can point out one specific way, it was social media.
Mm-hmm.
Because both you and I, and a lot of your listeners, if not all of your listeners, we all now get our news in such a different fashion than we got it 20, 30, 40 years ago. We used to depend on television and radio for all of our news.
Right.
And the newspaper. I'm a bit of a throwback, even though I don't do it anymore because I don't have to because it has different content. But I love the fact that I would have to go to the driveway to get my newspaper.
Yeah, yeah.
And the newspaper just doesn't carry the same weight figuratively and in other ways that it used to. We get all of our news off of our phone. A lot of our news off of our phone. And a lot of that changed. And having to deliver the news over the air of television with a microphone and a camera and in a studio. But then you had to do it through electronic social media. And that changed a lot of the way that I perceived the job and that I did my job. Mm-hmm. And it just wasn't as enjoyable.
So what did you wind up liking the most about it and the least about it? I think maybe the least was not having time with your family, Al. Is it that go without saying?
Yes, that's what I like the least about the job. What I like most about the job, Steve, and this is what the book, One for the Coyotes, and I know we talk about the Roadrunner and Wile E. Coyote, but I think you can say that word coyote or
Coyotes.
Coyote either way.
Mm-hmm.
And it really goes back, this is chapter 4 in the book, I grew up in, for the most part, in a military family. Mm-hmm. But by the time I was 10 years old, we had settled just west of Fort Worth in a small town called Mineral Wells, just about the size of Lee Summit. And high school football coach there had been there for a while. And I knew that when I was in the seventh grade, I was hoping that he would still be the head coach throughout my high school career. So 4 or 5 years, we all worked under his system. We had one team, Steve, in not only in our district, but in our state that dominated. Hmm. But the team in our state, in our district, I should say, that dominated were the Coyotes of Wichita Falls High School. They won 5 state championships. Now, I'm an old guy, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm 62 now. But they won 5 state championships between 1945 and 1969. 1969, I'm a seventh grader. And so whenever we did drills, and high school football is big in Texas, much bigger than either the state of Missouri or Kansas. It's huge. It's such a community mm-hmm. involvement activity. Mm-hmm. But whenever we did drills, knowing that it was a long shot to beat the Coyotes, but whenever we did drills, whenever we put our mind to anything connected to football, whether we did 10 push-ups or sit-ups or pass routes or weights, weight room, whatever we did, laps, we did 10. Let's say we had to do 5 or 10, a set of 5 or a set of 10. We always had to do one more for the Coyotes.
Huh.
That was the only way we succeeded or had a chance to beat the Coyotes, to compete with the Coyotes. One for the Coyotes. It became a work mantra of mine.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how did that relate to my career in television? Well, after I went to college and didn't play football anymore, television provided a teamwork atmosphere for me, mm-hmm. putting together a newscast, a sportscast. I didn't have one game a week on Friday nights anymore. I had 2 or 3 games a day because right. we had 2 or 3 newscasts a day. And so that work ethic helped guide me, helped promote me, and lead me through 40 years of television news. That was the best thing, to answer your question. That was the best thing about working in television, being part of a team each and every day, having a game in some ways 2 or 3 times a day.
I mean, nobody who knows you at all would have guessed, I mean, that would be your pick for what you enjoyed most about covering sports. They would have said, hey, watching Patrick Mahomes throw the ball 50 yards in the air or something. But here for you, it was teamwork, being with your colleagues in the newsroom, putting out a quality product every day.
I love sports in so many ways, Steve, and I got to put on top of the list is the way that sports can help us socially.
Mm-hmm.
Sports is a tremendous motivator. It can be a tremendous example on how we lead our lives. I'm currently working. I teach at the University of Kansas as an adjunct lecturer at the J School mm-hmm. in Lawrence,
mm-hmm.
And I'm teaching a class, Sports, Media, and Society. And a big part of sports is how it helps relate, how it helps us throughout our daily lives. There are so many life lessons that we can learn through sports and many other endeavors. Don't get me wrong, it's not the only one, but it's absolutely the one that's helped work for me. And I saw that not only in a sports competition, but I can take some of the life lessons learned there and apply them to my life and the way that I'm able to teach and the way that helped me get through 40 years of an industry that I was absolutely in love with, and that's television.
L. Wallace will speak about his new book, One for the Coyotes, at 6:30 tonight at the Kansas City Public Library's Central Library downtown. That's at 14 West 10th Street. More information, kclibrary.org. Is there a moment, L, that stands out to you of all the sports you've seen in this community, an athletic feat that just blew your mind, a defeat that you still recall? What's the moment?
You mentioned the word defeat. The two biggest defeats, Steve, that I can remember just wholeheartedly, that were just crushers, that were just really difficult for me to watch a team go through, was in 1997 when Kansas had one loss and lost to Arizona in a Sweet 16
yes.
game
yes.
in Birmingham, Alabama.
Yep.
And that team had Jock Vaughn, Jared Haase, Rafe LaFrance, Scott Pollard, Paul Pierce. I mean, it was the best. It could have been the best Kansas basketball team ever,
mm-hmm.
but they never made a Final Four. And the second loss that I would say would be equivalent to that, that I happened to witness, was when the Chiefs lost that playoff game in 95 when Lynn Elliott
yes.
Lost to the Colts.
Yes. Yes.
It must have been 4 degrees outside. They lost to the Colts. 13-10, I think, was the final score. It was just a crusher. And watching that Chiefs team try to handle that loss in that locker room, I mean, I didn't shed a tear, but I could have. It was like they had lost a life.
How hard is it?
They would have lost one of their nine lives.
How hard is it for a sports journalist to go into a locker room like that and ask the questions you've got to ask at a time like that, Al?
You make a good point there when you say you've got to ask,
mm-hmm.
because the viewer, the listener, the fan who paid to get into that game, they want to know why this happened, how did it happen, how does it affect you? Because they paid, they either took the time to watch it, to listen to it, or they paid for the ticket to go see it. And sports, at its foundation, is entertainment, just like mm-hmm. it's a singer or mm-hmm. a performer. People pay to see this entertainment. So, and you can't let all 70,000 fans into the locker room. So I'm a part of the media, and I've got to go in there and get the answers for the people who want the answers, the consumers. And so some are easier than others. A win is always much more enjoyable to cover, but those were tough, especially when you got to know some of these guys mm-hmm. and you had to ask them, why did you do this on that
yes.
play? Why didn't you do that? Those are never easy situations, especially in losses that mean so much.
How often did a professional athlete look you in the eye, either at a moment like that or any other time, Al, and say, Al Wallace, get out of my face. I don't have time for this right now.
A couple of times, a number of times. I'm not going to get into a specific, but never, ever once, especially with a player, never once did I think that they weren't justified in saying, or asking me, why did you ask me that question at this particular time?
Hmm.
You've got to respect that athlete or that coach who's trying to absorb a setback, something negative. One thing about a season, Steve, you basically prepare for in so many different ways, and you only get one season per year.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you lose that game, you've got to wait another year before you're back at that particular point to have another opportunity to supersede that failure.
Mm-hmm.
And so just think of how long a year is and how much work you have to put in over a year just to have the opportunity to get back to rectify that mistake or that setback.
Sportscaster Al Wallace is my guest. You said, and you said it here today, Al, and you say it in the book, that you worked hard not to get emotionally involved with the teams you covered. Why is that?
Because there were times, Steve, early in my career where I would absolutely positively get too connected to a local team. And I felt you had to safeguard against that. You have to remain neutral, because so many times I would allow the outcome of that game, whether it was a win or a loss, or that contest, whether it was a win or a loss, to affect me and to take my judgment out of neutral. And a lot of that had to do with Kansas basketball that had so many setbacks during the 90s when Roy Williams was the head coach. I used to enjoy watching those games so much. And when they would lose and not make it to a Final Four, have a setback, it affected my perception of the game. So I just stopped getting emotionally attached. I tried to. It's difficult. I'm mm-hmm. not saying I never did after that. It was just more of a challenge. It became less of a challenge, too, because I let it affect my life and the way I presented my job, and that wasn't fair to the viewer at the time.
You just answered my next question, because I was going to ask if your attitude, your approach applied to KU basketball, because you write at length in the book about how much you enjoyed the sport and the atmosphere and the coaches, for that matter. Bill Self wrote the foreword to your book. How close have you gotten to Roy Williams and Bill Self?
Much closer to Bill Self than I was to Roy Williams, and that's not by design. Nothing against either man, Roy, you know. But Bill Self was just so much more, in my opinion, he was less guarded.
Mm-hmm.
We're not best friends, but Do I have his phone number? Yeah. Understand this too, Steve, and for your listening audience. I've got a huge connection, I would say a significant connection to Lawrence, Kansas. You know, I met my wife at a KUMU football game. My wife was born in Lawrence and grew up on a farm south of Lawrence, mm-hmm. insisted, although we lived in Prairie Village and Overland Park at the time, that both our kids be born in Lawrence. So while she was in labor, I was, you know, behind the wheel, struggling and speeding to get her to Lawrence Memorial Hospital. So both of our kids could be born in Douglas County at Lawrence Memorial Hospital.
Wow.
And it goes beyond that. I've covered so many games here, football, basketball, and a lot of other sports. But this has become almost a second home. I've become attached to, in numerous ways, to Lawrence and to the school.
And one of your daughters was in the pep band, I think?
Yes, mm-hmm. yes. Graduate of the University of Kansas, the School of Music. And in 2017, I have another daughter. My youngest daughter is now a sophomore here at KU. So, and her dad's teaching. So it's been a solid connection.
Why was working in Kansas City such a draw for you, Al?
Because it provided, when I took the job at WDAF in 1985, it provided something that was a goal of mine, was to work in a market that offered professional sports, Chiefs, Royals, and the Kings had just left for Sacramento, mm-hmm. like 3 weeks before I started work. And it also offered a healthy college environment, major college sports, football and basketball and others. But it also provided a high school environment because I grew up playing high school football in the state of Texas. So I had all three. And it's such a tremendous sports community. It's grown. Soccer and just, the Kansas City Sports Commission does such outstanding work. It's just so many different levels. Sports architecture, you got to mm-hmm. say Kansas City's the home base.
Right.
So many different reasons.
You were the sixth of eight kids, and you came, as you've already said here, from a military family. How did that shape your life?
FOE, family over everything.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in a military family, and it was almost part, Steve, like being part of a team. We lived around the world because my dad was in the military. 1963, we lived right outside Washington, D.C. I lived for 3 years between the ages of 7 and 10. We lived in Darmstadt, Germany. I talk about that in the book. Family is extremely important to me, and it started with my mom, my dad, and my seven siblings.
You came out with a sense of discipline that you say served you your entire career. Tell us about that.
My dad, being in the military, tremendous mm-hmm. disciplinarian. I had friends knock on the door. They didn't say, can Al come out and play? They said, has Al passed inspection? And the discipline that I learned from him helped me during my high school football career. And it's helped propel me, and it's helped motivate me through my professional life. I believe my life is in some ways governed by systems and through discipline. And it's something that I've tried to give to my kids with two girls. It hasn't always been easy. They don't mow the yard. I still do. But it's
I know the feeling, Al. Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of people may not know this either, but you have a nearly lifelong fascination with the Kennedy assassination from, obviously, 1963. Where did that come from?
First grade. I remember this. The secretary rushing in the room
mm-hmm.
and shouting, the president's been shot. I was born just outside of Fort Worth, Texas, and outside of Dallas, my mom grew up. And that day, November 22nd, 1963, I remember going home, had a half a day school. They let school out early, mm-hmm. had a half a day. I'm in the first grade, had a half a day. I went home. My mom's watching As the World Turns and just consumed by that day. I remember it like it was yesterday. And then when she couldn't get a hold of her mom, my grandmother lived outside Dallas. And so when we'd visit grandma, when we finally settled in Texas when I was 10 years old, we'd go visit grandma all the time. We never would drive to see my grandmother without passing by the school book depository
right,
building.
Right.
And so I became fascinated with that history. I'm fascinated with history itself. I think it's extremely important.
Did Lee Harvey Oswald act alone, Al?
I believe so, yes.
You had a very positive relationship with Frank Bohl. What did you admire about him so much?
Frank and I connected early in our time together, mainly because I understood Frank and his foundation. Growing up in Western Pennsylvania, being from a disciplinary family, and playing high school football. Some people don't know this. Frank Bohl went to the same high school as Dan Marino, the Miami Dolphins quarterback.
Yeah.
Frank Bohl won a state championship at Central Catholic High School in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, undefeated. Dan Marino never did that. Dan Marino was an all-pro, a Hall of Famer.
Right.
Frank Bohl was, in my opinion, the best sportscaster Kansas City's ever had.
Give me some a few word description of some of the people I'm going to throw out here, people you've covered over the years, Al. Pat Mahomes.
I asked his dad, Pat Mahomes, what should we call your son, Patrick Mahomes II? He said Patrick.
Huh.
So Patrick Mahomes, the current quarterback of the Chiefs, is above all the rest right now, the number one, the best quarterback in the National Football League.
How about Norm Stewart, the former MU basketball coach?
Storm and Norman, a legend. Just personifies the state of Missouri and Missouri basketball forever.
How about Eric Hosmer, the former Royals first baseman?
World champion. The best first baseman the Royals have ever had. John Mayberry is a close second, but world champion. And just exemplifies 2015, world champion Kansas City Royals.
One more, Al. Joe Montana, the former Chiefs quarterback.
Played here 2 years. I still say he was a one and done. It was great while it lasted, but he didn't win a championship here. And I hope Mahomes will. I feel, though, he will.
That's Al Wallace, a former WDAF sportscaster. He'll speak about One for the Coyotes at 6:30 tonight at the Kansas City Public Library downtown, 14 West 10th Street. More info, RSVP at kclibrary.org. Al, what a pleasure it's been to have you. Thanks for taking some time.
Thank you, Steve. I'd love to be back anytime.
You bet. Last week on the show, Kansas City chocolatier Christopher Elbow shared his pro tips on chocolate shopping just in time for the holidays. Hear those and other episodes of the program at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, a look at the gender gap in the cybersecurity industry and a Kansas City group working to bring young inner-city girls into the field. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Jamie Hobbs. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.